Mediterranean Real 7.
Yes, we were talking the Gurkha soldier, and it is true that however low in status level one thinks one is or has been, one could not really go lower in the strata than is the entrant of a Nepalese farmer to the Gurkha battalions. So he starts, therefore, from a basis of nothing. But he strives at all times to become good, equally as good as his father, if he could. He seems always to quote his father, or big brother, or cousin, as being the example that he tries to emulate at all times. And I think the example, therefore, of a Gurkha soldier is such that we could all do with being, so to speak, because he has all his basics right. He knows he has little or no background, but he knows there's a whole future for him ahead if he's a good boy, does as he's told, takes all the discipline necessary, and becomes the fighting soldier that his father, as a Gurkha before him, had shown. So I can therefore talk in nothing but the highest possible terms. And if I could have chosen my career all over again, I would certainly consider that to be a most wonderful opportunity to go in as a British officer heading up a battalion of Gurkha soldiers.
How do they differ from British people?
To start with, they do not argue or question. That's the first thing. Not that that's necessarily wrong, that they argue or question, but they do not. They accept the whole thing, that they are part and parcel of a family of men who represent the King of England, as it was in my day, no doubt the Queen now, called to the colours. They do everything without questioning. Even in at pain of death, they would not question. They're faithful, ideally, right through. I have never known or ever known of any Gurkha soldier who would do otherwise than what he would know, the loyal and the correct and the proper thing in accordance with his rank. And seldom indeed, by virtue of their lack of education, do they get much higher than an Havildar. Was that sergeant in England, 3 stripes? Seldom, and he's got to be a good chap who gets to Havildar, and he'll have to have done 10 or 12 or 15 years to make Havildar anyway. So when he joins from his native Nepal and gets through to the crown rank, the ranks of the crown rather, he knows he's got a long time of being a private soldier. Unlike our people here, who perhaps want to aspire to great heights within a year, or think they're failing otherwise, he accepts things exactly as they are and joins just to be able to be like his dad was, or his uncle, or big brother, if you will. A fine chap, par excellence. You would not know within the whole of the British Army a better fighting man than is the Gurkha soldier.
Just finally, if I could ask you about Len Tein, if you've got any memories about him personally.
Yes, again, all the very, very best. He called me to one side once in a moment of desperation. I think I would have been about 30 years of age when he was then 45. He really ought not to have come into the Second Wingate Expedition, because at 45 years of age, you're asking a lot of you to stand the strain, the physical strain, of that kind of soldiering. Even at 30, there were chaps with me who were 18 and 20 and thought I was over the hill, let alone he, the brigadier, at 45. He called me on one side one occasion. He said, Frankie, do you know I shall make damn sure in my future that my two sons will never, ever have to put up with what their father's putting up with. I said, well, how come, sir? Not knowing his line of thinking. He said, this. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, just that. He said, look at us, like a load of savages, living like dogs. Here am I at 45 years of age, a staff officer, which he was. He said, why do I want to be on active service when I could have a damn good job back at GHQ as full colonel and a nice desk to sit at and some pleasantries in life which I don't now have? I said, well, I can understand that, sir. I would love it myself. Yes, of course you would. Well, he said, I tell you what I've done. He said, I've made dead sure my two sons will never do it. I said, have you, sir? What have you done to that then? He said, I put them both down at Dartmouth. He said, they're going into the Royal Navy. They are young commissioned officers already. And that, by the way, this would be 1944. So, God, they've been in and out of their service long since, haven't they? But Royal Navy, senior command, you know, this one. And the truth is that I've thought about that ever since, and I could understand that thinking, because to whatever degree of hardship those two sons would be put, at least they, God willing, they'd be on board ship, they'd have mess facilities and some good food, and they would never have the hardship of, if you like, jungle floors, as I had, as he, rather, Joe Lintain had, mosquitoes and the other filth. And if they were normally afloat, in any case, they'd enjoy that better way of life as is incumbent on the Royal Navy. Of course, if they had a shore job, I know that's a different thing, but he wanted them to be, his analogy in this was to think in terms of being Royal Navy, away from jungles and all this stuff, and not slogging it out like he is at age 45 years. And he said, what's more, Frankie, they'll be gentlemen, because they're brought up as gentlemen in the Royal Navy, you know, because they don't rough it as we rough it. And I think that was correct words at that time, and I've thought of it many times since. I think dear Joe had it right. I would like to have been, I didn't have a son, but if I had a son, I would have gone along with that same thinking. Because having since soldiered, or serviced rather, with Royal Navy personnel, I've always thought they seemed to have a cut above us chaps. In that sense, they always looked, I don't know if they were, but they always looked more gentlemanly. They were smart in appearance. Lord Louis, when he came to us, I know he came from a nice desk down at GHQ Delhi or some place like that, but he looked superb, you know. Of course, he saw us at our worst ever, and we felt at our worst ever because we were so scruffy. We were the ones living like dogs. When Lord Louis came in with all his lovely Royal Navy gear, looking the part. And I've always thought of naval officers as looking the part. I mean, we were always called officers and gentlemen, you know. I suppose some of us were and some of us weren't. But the Navy seems to be a cut, and I could see, and I now agree entirely with Joe's thinking. But he wanted his sons not to endure his hardships.
Do you think that Mountbatten was putting on a show, though?
No, sir, not any more than truth, no, because I had the good luck, you see. I knew Lord Louis Mountbatten, person to person. I knew him better than I know you, Conrad. And I worked with him closer than I am now talking to you, because you remember I told you the story of my blindness. Well, I came home, of course, UK, and I did 2 years on reserve. They sent me back to India, and I was posted to GHQ Delhi, and I AG's branch, by the way, Adjutant General's branch, GHQ Delhi. in the circus, as they called it then. And I had to write up what then became, and still is, 40 plus years afterwards, the training manuals for horses, ponies, donkeys and mules in the jungles of Burma. And the idea is, or rather the idea was then, and I gather it's still in being, namely that this manual is a training basis from which the Indian Army currently still works, namely the raising of units, like the training units I was in, number one driver training regiment, and then what you do with a horse and pony and donkey and mule afterwards, should it be that you go afar, you know, into areas outside your own country. And Lord Louis decreed that this should be written up, and I could see good thinking there, you see, on his behalf, excuse me. Namely, that he wanted all this written up while it was sort of fresh in the mind. I wrote it up, with the help, of course, at GHQ of people on typewriters and things. And in consequence, as his PA for this temporary period, it was less than a year, about 10 months of time, and Lord Louis was a superb chap to me personally. He always, you know, was a gentleman first and last and all the time. And I think of him in the highest possible terms. And I think when he came to us at Brigade, he was flying the flag all right. But it was simply a matter of fact. We ourselves could not have gone to the bathroom and washed and shaved that morning or anything, but he could. He came from an area where it was worth talking about, you see, whereas we were jungle wallows.